We're in this series that I've entitled Living Above the Fray, subtitle How to Thrive in Babylon. And one of the reasons why we're doing this series here is that occasionally all of us need to remember that we are, now hear me on this, that we are pilgrims and strangers and aliens here. Jesus says that we're in the world, but that we're not of the world. You need to understand the difference between those two prepositions. We're in it, but we're not of it. We're not byproducts of the culture. We're not byproducts of our society. We're not byproducts of the values of the system. We're not byproducts of this world. And Christians get themselves into terrible trouble when they try to syncretize those things. They try to marry those things. Now, don't hear me as saying, certainly, I mean, God gives us all things to enjoy, and we should enjoy our lives, and there's common grace and all of that. But we need to remember that we don't belong here. The way to be profoundly relevant, paradoxically, is to realize that the world doesn't give me definition. God gives me definition. God gives me definition. This book tells me who I am. And I bring that sense of wholeness to my moment in history. If you don't get that, you're going to live a life that is conflicted. You're going to always be struggling with who am I? Where do I fit in? Where's my purpose? What's fulfillment all about? Because you've never decided to embrace what God said about you. And that's what the book of Daniel largely is about. Now, this is not a study in the entire book, but we're taking a look at chapters 1, 3, 5, and 6. And there are four challenges that Daniel and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah went through. And we talked about the first challenge last week. It was a challenge of identity. And that was the place to start, the challenge of identity. In 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar ransacked and besieged Jerusalem, and he brought back to Babylon hostages. Brought back some of the royal family. And most scholars believe that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were children of some of those royal parents who were Jews that had been brought back to Babylon. And as I pointed out last week, and I didn't mean to be dramatic, you can check me out on this, but it's true. Most scholars believe chronologically that Daniel and his three friends could not have been at the top end, could not have been any older than 16 years old when they were brought into this training curriculum that would seek to undo their Jewish roots and make them, for all practical purposes, Chaldeans/Babylonians. Some say it was as young as 11. I put it somewhere in the middle, 13, 14 years old. Now, this is incredibly significant. So they go through this three-year program in which they are, quote, deprogrammed, pried away from their Jewish heritage. They even go so far as to change their names from the names of the gods, of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Elohim, Daniel, Mishael, and Yahweh, Azariah. Names that represent the nature of the singular God of the Jews to Babylonian Chaldean names, so that every time that they would call them, it would trigger in them this new identity, this new relationship, that you're more Babylonian than you are Jewish. And then in verse 8 of chapter 1, they made a decision that charted the course of the rest of their lives. Daniel deciding for his three friends, or speaking for his three friends, when they wanted to give them the king's meat and stuff and feed them this stuff. Because this meat had been offered to idols, these kids, their parents had taught them what Exodus taught them, that they shouldn't do this. And so the text says that they purposed, resolved in their hearts that they would not defile themselves. And that decision molded the direction of their lives and bought God's favor. Now, fast forward here, we're jumping into chapter 3. Chapter 3 is the challenge of idolatry. Now, I wish I didn't have to say this, but, you know, all of us have heard the story of Daniel and his three friends here in the fiery furnace. Actually, the fiery furnace was Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and we want to call them the three Hebrew boys. The three Hebrew boys. I hate the puncture that bubble here. But chronologically, I mean, it sounds more dramatic. I like the story of the three boys, but chronologically, these dudes ain't boys. By the time chapter 3 comes around, they're probably in their late 30s or early 40s. But we like to call them the three Hebrew boys. Well, they're not boys, they're men. At this point, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah have so distinguished themselves. God's hand was over them. You remember the end of chapter 1, because they honored God, God blessed them, and they were 10 times more competent, proficient, and better than all of the others around them. Their peers weren't even close. Well, you see this in chapter 3. These Jewish guys are now over the province of Babylon. They're running it. But chapter 3 is the challenge of idolatry. Now, let me just say this. All of us struggle with idolatry. One old sage said, all of us have our hearts are idol factories. And all of us struggle with idolatry. Things that vie us away from our worship and single focus of God. There are all kinds of idols that we struggle with, that we battle with. In fact, in preparation for this message, I read a blog by Tim Challice that he wrote several years ago. And the blog is entitled The Hidden Power in Every Idol. And I just want to read a few excerpts from the blog. Challice says that the hidden power of idols is what they do to those who worship them. Those who make them become like them. So do all who trust in them. These idols have no power. They have no life. They have no purpose. And those who worship them mimic them until they are just like them, people of no power, no life, no purpose. They become every bit as ridiculous as those stumps of wood, those blocks of stone. D.A. Carson explains, what you worship, you soon resemble. More, you identify with it, defend it, make common cause with it. And if it is an abomination to God, soon you are an abomination to him. Worship an idol and you will resemble that idol. Worship what is useless and you will become useless. In the Western world, we are far too sophisticated for carved idols, of course. But we have idols of our own, respectable idols suited to 21st century sensibilities. If we worship the idol of a perfect body, the sweeping curves of the chiseled abs, we will become as vain and self-focused as the models in the magazines. If we worship the idol of money, we will become as greedy, selfish, and cutthroat as the worst wolf on Wall Street. If we worship athleticism, we will imitate superstar athletes in their arrogance, their moral depravity, their self-obsession. And if we worship the idol of power, we will mimic the flip-flopping, anything-goes, popularity-obsessed politician. On and on it goes. We become like that to which we give our allegiance. If we give our allegiance to something that is useless, empty, fleeting, then we become useless, empty, and fleeting. Idols are dangerous. Idols are dangerous. They're dangerous. We were created and made for a singular allegiance, a core allegiance, nothing even close, and that is to our great God. That's what we were born for. And these three men knew that. They knew that. They knew that they were born for a singular purpose. They were born for a singular mission, their great God. Now, here in chapter 3 is this great challenge of idolatry. Well, how did they handle this challenge? Well, I'm going to give it to you up close, give it to you up front first, and then we're going to walk through it. And I'll tell you the answer to that, and maybe you can go to sleep because the rest of it will just be filler. The way they dealt with it, number one, they didn't bow. Number two, they didn't bend. And number three, they didn't burn. They didn't bow. They didn't bend. And they didn't burn. Now you have to understand, at this point in their lives, they've had a lot more stake than they did in chapter 1. It could be argued that the older you get and the more success you have, the more attached you can become to the success that you have. And so at this juncture in their lives, it's safe to say, in the reading in between the lines, they've got prominence, they've got popularity, they've got a modicum of resources, life is good for them, they are leaders in this kingdom. Why rock the boat? Why rock the boat? They could have like just put it in neutral, but they did not do it. So the very first thing that's happening here is that they did not bow. Now, I'm going to walk through this story and let the story really, really be the illustrations of what's going on, because it is a powerful, compelling story. Most of us, if you've been around church any longer than a few months, you've heard this story probably 5 times. The very first thing is that they didn't bow. Now, what's going on here? Well, what's going on here is that Nebuchadnezzar, you know, he was obsessed with himself. He was over the moon, over the top, narcissistic. I mean, this man was the most powerful man in the then known world. And check out what old Nebuchadnezzar does. He makes this image. Verse 1 says, "Then King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." Now, most scholars will say without equivocation that this statue was a statue of yours truly, Nebuchadnezzar. He was full of himself. And although it doesn't specifically say that, as you read here and then over in chapter 4, you begin to understand, you connect the dots. This man was obsessed with himself and his own prominence and his own power. Now, this statue was humongous. It was 90 feet tall. That's kind of like the equivalent of a 6-story building. 9 feet wide. It was set on the plain of Dura. Now, scholars don't exactly know where Dura is. Most of it probably was on the outskirts of Babylon as you were coming through a major thoroughfare. So as you come through, you'd see homeboy themselves greeting you, you know. And so, and then he says, okay, we're going to have this gala celebration, this dedication. So all the officials are there. That's where the satraps and all these dudes are. All the officials are there. I mean, it is an amazing thing. They are gathered there. And you can imagine, probably also there's a crowd of other people there, Babylonians as well, but all these officials are there. And now, if you go down to verse 4, I'm going to read verses 4 through 6. When this proclamation is made, listen to what they're supposed to do. Verse 4 says, "And the herald proclaimed aloud, 'You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down,'" here you have it, "'and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up.'" Worship him. "And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up." Here you have it. I don't know whether there was some covering around it or how they unveiled this thing or whatever, but when the music start playing, bam, boom, and there's homeboy, everybody's falling down and worship. Everybody. Now, I don't mean to be excessively dramatic here, but you have to understand, sometimes we are so familiar with these stories that we don't sense the reality and emotion of what's going on. You are a Jew. You have distinguished yourself. You run the province of Babylon. You're not down the food chain on the organizational chart. You're right up front. And everybody bows. With 3 dudes. And you know the dude's crazy.
You know, he doesn't suffer or even put up with a hint of insubordination. And when he says you're going to burn in a fiery furnace, he means that. This ain't figurative. Everything you have is on the line. This was not inconspicuous. This was expensive. But you didn't bow. And the reason why they didn't bow was because they knew God's faithfulness. They remember when they were 14 years old. And they resolved that they weren't going to defile themselves. And that was a lifelong decision. That wasn't a decision of choice for the moment. That wasn't a decision just to get off the hot seat for then. And they knew that God had favored them and blessed them because of that decision and choice. You see, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to institute a new form of religious worship there. In fact, a lot of scholars believe that what he wanted to do was that he would be the summum bonum. He would be the ultimate one to be worshipped. He would eclipse the regular gods of the Babylonians. That he would be supreme. By the way, you need to go ahead and read chapter 4. That's when God says, okay, we had enough of this nonsense. So he was usurping all of these gods, and he wanted people to worship him. And he just required and demanded absolute submission and fidelity to his authority without question. All right, so that's the image. Well, what happens? Well, you know, the tattletales come, and I say this not because I'm African-American, but just read the text. This is one of the most severe, obnoxious demonstrations of racism that you'll ever read anywhere in the Bible. You know, here you have these Jews now, and can you imagine you're there, and these other guys, these Chaldeans, these Gentiles are saying, hey, hold up, man, you're supposed to be our servants, not our leaders. We brought you over here as slaves, Jack. What are you talking about? So, here's the accusation in verse 8. So they didn't bow to the image, and the tattletalers come in verse 8. It says, therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. That's put on there on purpose. Maliciously accused the Jews. This was not about just saying that these dudes didn't bow. This was about eradicating the Jews from their structure. Maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar. Now listen to how these dudes kiss up to him. O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, bagpipe, harp, and etc., and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. I can imagine king said, yeah, I know what I said. Get on with this thing here. And verse 11 says that whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And then verse 12, there are certain Jews, as if they didn't want to point them out. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Now, this is partially true. It's partially true. The paying no attention to you is a lie. They were loyal to them and this kind of thing. The second part is the true part. No, they didn't worship the gods. They're clear about that. They didn't worship the gods. They understood that God said, you shall not have any other gods before me. God didn't stutter. That was clear. And it doesn't make any difference whether you are Nebuchadnezzar, or Leroy.
It didn't make any difference. We don't do that. We don't worship any other gods but the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We don't do that. Now listen to me. I don't mean to sound like some little legalist riding a hobby horse here, but you got to get to a point in life, and I know it sounds negative, but young people, I want you to listen to me. You got to get to a point in your life where you say there's certain things I will not do. And part of the problem I have with some of the younger generation is that they leave their options open. Well, leaving options open ain't all bad, but they leave their options open when in terms of character and morality. You don't leave those options open. So they told them. Well, now we got us an issue here. We got us a real issue. We got us a problem. So they didn't bow. Well, secondly, they didn't bend. I'm always conflicted when I read this these next two paragraphs here of the narrative, because I think we can get a little bit too hard on Nebuchadnezzar. If you consider his context, there's a side of me that kind of understands why he gets a little bit bent out of shape as you walk through this. Now, let me explain. Verse 13 says, he's going to give them a second chance, okay? So look at verse 13. It says, then Nebuchadnezzar is furious. In furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. I mean, he's ticked. He said, they did what? They didn't do what? You're not talking about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You can't be. I mean, these are the ones that run. Yeah, bring them here. So he's ticked. Well, they bring them there, and I don't know if there's an ellipsis between verse 13 and 14 or whatever, but I'd like to think that maybe these other tattletales are out of the room, and Nebuchadnezzar says to them, now look, verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? I don't think he was expecting necessarily an immediate answer. I think he was just saying, this is to be taken, well, you certainly can't be doing this. I mean, I've known you since you were teenagers. I've seen you progress, and I've seen your loyalty to me. What do you can't do this. And this is so out of character for this man. You see, he really did like them. He liked them. They didn't play the little political games to maneuver up the chain of command, and they didn't play power stuff and the little, organizational gossip things and stabbing people in the back and this kind of. Their lives were just remarkably orchestrated. They outperformed everybody. There's something different about these dudes. And so he says, I'm going to do something that is totally out of character. Verse 15. Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe and lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I've made, well and good. Forget about it. That'll be all over. You can do this. If you do that, this never happened. Okay? This never happened. But if you do not worship, and this is where homeboy gets into trouble. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. I don't know, and I'm being a little bit loose here with the text, admittedly. I don't know if he had stopped there, this may have been a bit of a deal that could have caused them to compromise, and maybe they could have rationalized and said, hey, let's humor him. We will bow on our knees, but we'll be standing up in our hearts. And, God doesn't want us to lose all of this traction that we have and the prominence and the influence that we have here. Look at our kids there. Go to the finest schools. We live in a nice place here. We got all this stuff going on here. Why throw all of this away? They could have said that. But when homeboy makes this next line, It was as if God threw a bucket of cold water in their faces to wake them up. He says here, "And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Whoa, wait a minute. You didn't seriously say that, did you? You did not seriously say that. "And who is the God?" And who is the God? I can imagine them thinking, you really don't understand how we got here, do you? You thought you gave us this position. God has orchestrated our steps all of these years. All of these years. You just need to know something. Yeah. We work for you, but we serve Yahweh. We don't serve you. We work for you, but we serve Yahweh. He's been faithful. Well, then they go on to answer. This is where their firm conviction comes to the surface. I said this last week, and I want to underscore it again here. You must understand the difference between beliefs and convictions. And parents, as you teach your children, they must understand at a certain point in their lives the difference between beliefs and convictions. You can make them conform to certain beliefs, but they will not necessarily live out their convictions. Convictions are the things that you will die for. You might put it this way. I've always said convictions are your beliefs that have been tested and internalized. They're the beliefs that have been up here. They've been tested, but now they're internalized. You don't just believe it. You believe it viscerally. This ain't for sale. This ain't for sale. And this is how they respond to him. They respond to him. Listen to how they respond to this narcissistic egomaniac. And that's not hyper statement. As you read chapter 4, you understand that ain't a hyper statement here. Verse 16 says, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter.'" They weren't being smart aleck. They weren't being caustic. What they were saying is, you know our lives. You've seen what we believe. You know what we stand for. We have not been hidden about our fidelity to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We have not hidden what we believe about him. You've seen that. We don't need to give you an essay about our position. We don't need to give you some little rationale theologically as to why we've come to this conclusion. You've seen it. And furthermore, they say, listen, and since you brought it up, we didn't bring it up. Since you brought it up, we didn't bring it up. You want to talk about his ability? If this be so, verse 17, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. I mean, this must have really, I could see this guy, he's about ready to stroke out. But I love verse 18, but if not, if he chooses not to physically deliver us, and even if we must die for what we believe, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. We don't need a caucus. We don't need an interaction. We don't need an advisor to come here. We have made up our mind. This is the line. We ain't crossing it, man. We resolved when we were 14 years old that we weren't going to defile ourselves. That decision stands. Listen, there are a lot of things worse than death. There's a whole lot of stuff worse than death. If you kill us, we'll be with him. But we are not going to sell out. Well, that didn't go too well. They didn't bow. They didn't bend. Ultimately, they didn't burn, but we got to get there first. Verse 19. I shouldn't say this. But any parent here who has had a confrontation, let's say, with their teenager, who has
had a brain cramp with regard to their behavior and terrible choices can understand this opening line. Verse 19 says, "Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury, and the expression of his face changed." Who are you talking to? You talking to me? Somebody else? You didn't say it to me. Somebody else must be in this room. You said it to me? You telling me what you're not going to do? Seriously? The clothes that you have is because of me. The place where you live in is because of me. The position, you're going to tell me? Don't you know who you're dealing with? So this man is so full of fury. Listen to what he does. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated. Now, I'm a little incensed. I'm a little off here. But it would seem to me now, you know, see, somebody said, a man full of fury is full of folly. If you wanted the dudes to suffer, if anything, you turn it down and let them burn slowly. So my man, he's so ticked off. He wants them immediately just disintegrated, evaporated, or whatever. So he orders them to do it. They heat this thing up 7 times hotter than it's supposed to be heated. And verse 20, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them to the burning fiery furnace. This is nuts right here. Then these men were bound in their cloaks and their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. He just wanted to get rid of every remembrance of them. Fire. Verse 22 says, because the king's order was urgent and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You gotta get the flame is so hot. My research indicates that the furnace probably was this big opening that you put the fuel in down this way. When these dudes, it was so hot, when they got close to it, shoved them in, they died. There's a little detail here that you should not skip over, however. Verse 22 says, and these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Now, I'm curious. Everything that they had was combustible that was put on them. The men that threw them in, they got so close that the fire burnt them and killed them. And yet, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah was still bound. I don't want to make too much of this, but God was waiting for the right moment to put Nebuchadnezzar in his place. Let me tell you something. Hear me on this. Don't pray for premature deliverance. God may be doing far more in your fiery furnace of trial right now to impact others than you could ever dream or imagine. And your pain may not be just about you. You hear me? Your pain, your struggle, your turmoil, your trial may not be just about you. It could be a much broader thing that God is doing. So when he says, wait, 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 trust him. So I guess my man says, well, we're done with this. We're done with this. Not really. Look at verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose in haste. He declared to his counselors, did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire? And they answered and said to him, true, O king, now I know you can count higher than 3. And my man was probably saying, but don't look at me. I see 4. The king said,
I see four men unbound and walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. These other dudes die. They're not hurt. And the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods. Well, what's going on here is this. You see, there are two messages, I really believe, from this. When Nebuchadnezzar says, "And what God is there? What God is there who can deliver you out of my hand?" God's saying, "Seriously, Nebi? Really? Really? You think you're competition with me? Really?" See, this is the reason why arrogance and hubris are so stupid. It says, you, just who do you think you are? So God says, let me just wait for the right moment. So the first message is that God is all powerful and not you, Nebuchadnezzar. The second message is this: wherever Jesus is, there's freedom and fellowship. You know, he didn't know who the Son of God looked like or anything like that, but I think the import here when he says a figure as a son of the gods, what he meant by that, the fourth person in there ain't human. He ain't completely like us. He looks a little bit like us, a little anthropomorphism going on here. He looks a little bit like us, but he ain't one of us. This fourth one's supernatural. Most scholars believe that this wasn't a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus. And notice that they were unbound and walking about. Hear me on this. Wherever Jesus is, wherever he is, there's no such thing as being in bondage. There's no such thing as being in bondage. Wherever Jesus is, there's freedom. There's freedom. All your circumstances might be restrictive, but there's freedom wherever Jesus is. Secondly, walking about wherever Jesus is, there's fellowship. You don't have to be at a special place to enjoy intimacy with God. God said, "I will meet my children's need in the midst of this fire. I'll encourage their hearts. In the midst of what you mean to devastate them and destroy them, I will use it to bless and encourage them. Because I'm right here in the fire." And some of you need to hear this today. Stop procrastinating your joy and stop procrastinating putting off senses of freedom. "Well, when my circumstances change, I'll enjoy the Lord. Oh, when this takes place, I'll enjoy him." No. You need to enjoy him in the midst of your pain. Right in the midst of the trial. Well, there's an epilogue here. The epilogue is found over in verse 28. The full-born epilogue is found over in chapter 4 with Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation. But notice, different tune here in verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." He was talking about his gods and what God could deliver you out of my hand. "Who has sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own God." Nebuchadnezzar said, "I got it. I'm backing away from this one. I got it. Oh, I would to God that the powers to be in this country would get this. I would to God that they get this. Stop being so blasted arrogant, obsessed and filled with power." It might take the persecution of God's people and his powerful deliverance to send this message to our culture and our society. And even to the secular world, God says, I will not have any gods beside me. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar was a secular, non-believing Gentile leader. He had no covenant relationship with God. But God says, when you mess with my name and you mess with my people, you mess with me, and that ain't a good thing. Now, I'm too long this morning. Let me just give you sort of four takeaways or things to keep in mind that come out of this whole idea and this whole issue of idolatry. Number one is this. We need to be aware of our own pull toward idolatry, and all of us have it. I have it. We all, there are things in us that are disproportionate in our thinking. I don't know what it might be. It might be some hobby that you have. It might be some social issue or political emphasis or whatever it might be, the garden variety of stuff. We all have things that we're too concerned with, that we're tempted to obsess over. And I think what we all need to do is make sure that we identify those things, because those things have ways of determining our emotional well-being. We get all bent out of shape, or our responses and this kind of, and that's not a good thing. That's not a good thing, especially during this political season. That ain't a good thing. So we all need to be careful and identify the potential idols in our hearts and lives. And remember, an idol is anything that really changes the trajectory of my behavior and responses. Secondly, we need to confront our idols. The way you deal with idols, you can't be passive about it. You have to know what they are and then confront them. Figure out what's wrong about it. Speak to it. And declare our fidelity and allegiance to our great God. The third thing I would suggest to you that we do is this. I would suggest that we fast from those things that could have an unhealthy that we could have an unhealthy attachment to. Yeah, you know, I've done this with certain things that I've gotten too involved with, or it's gotten too important to me, and I just backed away from it a little bit. You know, some of us, it could be, hey, I don't know, could be golf. Seriously. And maybe what we need to do, we find ourselves just kind of like working everything around to do this thing, and this kind of, and it's gotten too high of a value to us. You know what I'm saying? It's just too high of a value. And what we just back away from it. Some of us, we're watching too much news. And we're like junkies when it comes to that. And what's underneath all of that is that we're looking for fire and fuel and this kind of thing. And, you know, we might need to let's fast from that for a little bit and get it down to where it needs to be. And the fourth thing I would say is this. Actually, the best way of overcoming idols is not the negative response to idols, but the positive response to God. The best way of overcoming idols is to get lost in the wonder and worship of our great God. To discipline ourselves on a daily basis to worship Him and practice the very presence of God. And when we're in His presence, all these other things have a way of falling back down to a proper perspective. Worship Him. Well, let's stand together. This world is not a friend of grace out here, okay? We got the world, the flesh, and the devil dealing with us. And idolatry is a dangerous thing because it diverts our attention from our great God. It erodes our faithfulness. It just sort of whittles away at our loyalty to our great God. Let's be vigilant, church. Let's be vigilant. If you're not a follower of the Lord Jesus, all you have to do is say, Lord Jesus, thank you for dying on the cross for my sin. I turn from my sin, and I trust you as my Savior and Lord. Father, thank you for yourself, and thank you for the power of your word. Thank you that it is always true. Lord, help us to be found faithful. God, may we not transfer our loyalty and allegiance to the stuff that people do for us, but may we be grateful for what people do, but may we always remember that all good things come from the hand of God, that we belong to you. Lord Jesus, fill us with a sense of your purpose for us and mission, and may we live our lives declaring the favor, the goodness, and the glory of our great God. None can compare to him. In Jesus' name, amen.